Well, as you can see, I have on our opening slide William Carey. I don't want to get too much into him now. We'll talk more about him in detail later. But I have his picture up here because he is considered the father of the modern missionary movement. I think we can, for lots of different reasons, first of all, because of his love for Christ and his desire to know people, he's worthy to be known for that. Secondly, he was a particular Baptist coming out of England and coming out of our background. The father of modern missions came from a Calvinist. Go figure that one. That seems to go against the mold of Calvinists. And we'll see very clearly that he was going to fight against what was going on in England among some of the Calvinists who would go towards their hyper-Calvinism. And so we have a lot to uphold William Carey for and the relation to him, and we'll talk a little bit more about him in detail later in the slides. But his saying, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. And that is a good summation of true Calvinistic theology. We don't just sit back and let God do it all and say if he wants it, he'll get it done. And yet we're very mindful that if less God does it, it will not come to fruition. We won't see the fruit of our labors. And so there's always that tension and balance in what we do. We should always look to be sovereign, the sovereign God to bless and to work through us. Nevertheless, we are to work, we are to attempt, we are to dream, we are to put ourselves at risk, and that's what Carey did, and so he's a good example for us. Well, we come in our study of church history. As you know, there are three periods of church history that we've put before you: the ancient church, the medieval church, and we've come today to the modern church. We're really at the end of our course. We only have a few lessons left. And so as you can see, we are going to be in this last section of revival, missions, and modernism. One thing just to note about church history, and we see it in every single period of church history, Christianity is a religion in one sense of contradictions, humanly speaking. When you think about the ancient church and the life of Christ, we'll even go back to our founder and the life of Christ, what did you find? Humanly speaking, you found somebody whose mission seemed to be a total failure, was going to die on a cross, in disgrace, his followers dispersed in shame. And yet the contradiction is such that in just a few centuries, his followers are going to overcome the greatest empire that ever ruled the world, the Roman Empire, overcoming the Jewish authorities in their land, and take over the known world. That's a contradiction. When we come to the medieval church, we're going to see the very same thing. We're going to see that it is going to grow, and then it's going to all of a sudden, in the outworking of the church, its darkest hour, the Reformation is going to come through some of the most unlikely sources. And we're going to see again the Spirit of God move through one person and change the entire establishment. Again, a very weak vessel, Martin Luther. And yet a great gospel message to come. And today when we come, and we could trace that theme in so many different ways throughout church history, but today we're going to see the same thing. We're going to see a great contradiction. We're going to see the Renaissance come to flower into the scientific age, and we're going to see the church challenged in its thinking and in its theology, to the point where in the early 1900s, most intellectual leaders are going to write off the church as a thing of the past, something to be discarded. And that thinking continues today because really we are in just barely out of the 1900s. And if you were to go to the great universities of learning today at Duke University or Carolina or Wake Forest or some others, Christianity is on their side set aside as something that is only for the weak of mind and the unintelligent. And yet, we're going to see that it is within that kind of an atmosphere that the church is going to flourish and spread throughout the world. Christianity is a religion of contradictions, humanly speaking. Well, we come then to this 1800s, the great century. Kenneth Scott Lauderette, one of the great Harvard historians, is called this the great century, and the reason being is really twofold. Number one, because of the great results that we're going to find in Christianity, the zeal and the reform that is going to come out of Christianity during the 1800s is very remarkable. And we're going to trace some of that. We're going to see it's great in its reach, in the fact that it is going to go into all the world, into all the known world. And yet, there are some very few spots of the world today, maybe, that you can go to. We know of some in Indonesia where we have contacts reaching people who have never, ever known anything of the outside world, let alone of Christ. But for the most part, the world was going to be touched by Christianity in some form. And so it is a great century nevertheless, and we're going to see that the spread of the church is going to have a great impact on it. Well, let's talk about the context of this great century. When I say the great century, what am I talking about in the context for which the church is going to come? Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that the great influence of the church to spread throughout the world is going to come from the spiritual revivals that we've just finished talking about. The Pietistic Revival and the Moravians in the early 1700s, and then we're going to have the Methodist revivals in England in the 30s to the 90s. That's very important. Pay attention to these dates here. We've already talked in detail about the First Great Awakening in our country, and in the Second Great Awakening in the 90s into the 40s, 1840s. We're talking about the 1800s here, the great century, the 1800s, the 19th century. I believe one of the key elements to understanding the spread of Christianity is to understand it as coming out of a context of the great revivals having occurred, the Spirit of God coming and breathing life into the church, into the passion of people and their hearts for Christ. You and I, as far as I know, have never known what it's like to be around somebody who's experienced a revival that occurred in that day. We've each had a revival in one sense in our own hearts. If we're joined to Christ, He's come and given us new life. But to have it done in a mass way, in such intense timing, you and I don't believe have ever known that, at least to the degree that we knew that day. And so we must remember it was in spiritual revivals that this great century is going to be born out of. But the second thing that I want to give you is, think about all the changes that are going to happen in the 1800s. Great modernization is going to go on, and I think you can argue, some do, I've read, that there was more change in people between 1800 and 1920 than in any other time in human history as far as development goes. Let's think about it. One of the things that's going to mark this is that from 1815 to 1914, for the most part, there was world peace. Now, that is a striking function to think about. The world, for the first time since Christ, is really going to be at peace. No world wars, no empires fighting each other. For this, the most part, Napoleon is going to end in 1815. World War I is going to occur in 1914. And so for this approximate 100 years, the world is going to be at peace. Granted, you can think of some exceptions in this country. One should pop out in your mind pretty quickly. The Civil War was a great one. There might have been some other wars, the Spanish-American War, and you can think of some European. But for the most part, there was no world war. When Paul tells us to pray for our leaders that there may be peace, one of the things that we need to remember is not only so that our lives will be easy, but so that the gospel can prosper. When a country is at war, it is very challenged in its ability to send out missionaries and to focus upon the world and its need for Christ. Well, this century is going to be marked largely by peace. There's going to be great scientific knowledge that is going to come to bear in the 18 and early 1900s. They're going to learn what germs are and how to fight disease, and the vaccinations are going to come. We're going to see surgery improve with antisepsis and anesthesia. Granted, it's not going to be until the late 1800s, but nevertheless, the ability to deal with men's physical needs is going to really come about to the fore, and the church is going to be able to use that. The Red Cross started basically as a Christian organization trying to deal with the needs of people. Chemicals to fight pests. I don't know what it would be like to live in a society where one out of every three people die, as it did in Europe during the Black Plague. But just look around you here and count. One out of every three dead, 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 dead. And so it is going to be a great blessing as we see that people will be able to live longer and have greater opportunity to know Christ. Genetics is going to start to come to the fore, and they start looking at seeds and how to select the proper seeds for the best food and breeding so that nutrition comes to the fore and people will live longer in this century. Great growth in technology, unbelievable growth in technology. Electricity, the telegraph and the telephone. Refrigeration, granted, it's not going to be in the homes, mostly industrial use, but it's going to be, for example, they'll have trains that have cars that can produce meat in Chicago and ship it to the east. We'll get boats so we can ship it over the ocean and not let it spoil. A huge improvement. Steam-powered factories and farm equipment are going to make our productivity so much greater than it had been for centuries before. Then there's going to be great growth in transportation. So when our missionaries seek to go across the world, they're going to do it not by sail, but by steam power, and be able to go across the ocean in a matter of days and not months. So we can see that there is great blessings, but there was also something going on with a great growth in prosperity. The Industrial Revolution, it certainly wasn't perfect. We're going to see, though, that very few are going to become very rich. But a large minority are going to become middle class. And there's going to be able to support missionary endeavors in the creation of this wealth. Granted, there's going to be many who are going to be very poor in the Industrial Revolution, and the church is going to have an opportunity to address those needs. But nevertheless, this is a century of unbelievable change. But then also we need to remember that Christianity during the 1800s is going to come under great assault. Think about what happens in the sciences. Darwin, Nietzsche, Comte, Huxley. These are all men. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm not sure about Darwin, but of the other three I did look up, every one of them came from a minister's family. Most of them trained to be Christian ministers, but they ended up doing whatever they could to discredit and defeat Christianity. The sciences are going to be a great challenge. Societal organization. Recognize that name, Karl Marx. He's going to be doing his work in 1860. It's going to be a great challenge to Christianity. Prosperity and urbanization. This is going to be the rise of the cities like New York and Chicago and London. We're going to see them just gather into these huge populations that are going to bring great challenge. There's going to be materialism, though, and in sin. If you think life is bad now, you don't have enough knowledge of 1800 New York City life. It was dreadful, both in its poverty, in its immorality, prostitution, drinking. It was awful. And quite frankly, New York City looks like a kindergarten today compared to what it was in the 1800s in this country. Read just even what it was to fight prohibition coming out of New York City and the alcoholism that was going on in the city in that day, in the late 1800s. It was a dreadful place to live. So anyway, Christianity is going to be assaulted in the 1800s. But I think it's also to understand in the context of this great century, this word colonialization. Now, what I've put up here is a map. It's probably a little bit difficult to see, but what I want you to note is that the different colors that you have, and particularly note that you would have these colors right here. That color is England, that color is going to be France, and that color is Spain, and there is Portugal. Those are the base colors that are going to go across the world in the 1800s. What is colonialization? And I have to admit, in my study putting this lesson together in the past and reviewing it today reminded me of a very important struggle that missionaries face when they go to another country. How do foreigners, they are not the foreigners, we are, as a foreigner, how are we perceived by the people we're trying to preach the gospel to? That's a key question. And what in that perception of us as a missionary can hinder the work of the gospel? Think about colonialism. This is one definition that I have of it. It is the extension of a nation's sovereignty over territory beyond its borders by the establishment of either a settler or exploitation, colonies, in which indigenous populations are directly ruled, displaced, or exterminated. Colonizing nations generally dominated the resources, the labors, and the markets. Now, what does that mean? When England went to India in the late 1600s and the 1700s to colonize India as one of its colonies, chiefly because it was going through the Industrial Revolution, it needed a place to ship it, big navy England had, to ship its needs, its supplies, its produce, its products to India. They needed India's resources. When they went to India, how did they treat the Indians? Read it. They treated them as dogs. They treated them as if they needed the English people. They went into India and made them to try and be British. I think you can say the same thing happening in Africa. These people were being colonized by people who they did not look at kindly. And so the question is, when Carey went to India, what did the Indian people think of him? He struggled with that, and we'll talk about it a little bit later in detail. But in the context, despite this view of the colonization of the world by England, by France, by Spain, by Portugal, even by the United States, the Christian work could go forward. And it did go forward. But it is something that will have to be dealt with. By the way, in 1900, look at the colors on that map. Let me show you the difference. Look at all the gray. No colonies. 100 years later, look at the colors. Can't see it very well and go into detail, but here's the point I want you to understand. In 1900, colonization was an issue. And there were a lot of people. For example, this would have been France's influence in Africa. Here is England's influence throughout the world. You can see that Spain is vastly going away, Portugal as well. But the point is, there was great colonization going on, and it wasn't always very pretty, and how the mother country, England, France, Spain, Portugal, was going to treat the colony. They saw it as a resource to be used for their good. Let me also say that oftentimes these countries that were colonizing other countries did not want missionary activity. If you remember that when Carey went to India, he was forbidden to preach the gospel by the English in their territory. And he had to go to a Dutch territory in order to establish his missionary work. It was the English who prohibited him from working in India. That's a fascinating thing to think about. Well, Christianity was challenged by the outside, whether it was the scientific world trying to attack it in its beliefs. But it also was going to have unprecedented opportunity. All of these technologies and all of these abilities were going to give them a chance to minister into the world. Let me just say, it skipped my mind as I was going through it, but when you think about the 1800s and the scientific attack upon the Bible, Germany, you would have thought, coming out of the Reformation, should have been one of the leading countries in the world. And yet, from this point forward, 1800s, even into the 1700s, Germany is a non-entity when it comes to Christianity, generally speaking. Liberalism, the same basic liberalism that hit Germany and New England, thus your congregational churches become Unitarianism or they go into deistic thinking, Germany is going to be taken over by liberalism. And it is going to be out of Germany that many of those who are going to attack the scriptures and their higher and lower criticisms are going to come from. It is a sad thing. And really, it's one of these contradictions that I was talking about. Luther is probably rolling over in his grave, figuratively speaking, when he thinks about 1800 Germany. And it is going to be Alexander Archibald Hodge and Charles Hodge and B.B. Warfield in our country, in Princeton and Westminster later, who are going to have to fight and try and defend what is coming out of predominantly liberal Germany. It is no surprise, and this is my opinion, and it is a great indictment, that Nazi Germany would be able to arise out of Germany, knowing that the way that they decimated Christianity, it was a very bright people, very gifted people, with great minds and intellect. But when you take their abilities and you turn it away from Christ into the deviousness of a fallen human heart, that's what you get out of it. And Germany is a good example of what happens. Well, great opportunity, but great threats. How is Christianity going to respond? Well, first of all, how do we take this religious awakening coming out of these great awakenings that we've studied? You mix it in with modern technology. What's going to happen? Well, first, I want us to focus our attention on social reforms. And then I'm going to turn our attention to the missionary endeavors that are going to flow out of it. All of these things can be used for God's glory, and I think you'll see that they were. Talk about social reform. Let's talk about social reform in America. First of all, it was the Christian church who is going to seek to prohibit against dueling. Seems like a small thing, but it's the churches that are going to address this in our country and not the government itself. Abolition of debtor prisons and general prison reform in this state is going to come, in this country, is going to come from the church. The prohibition movement of the late 1700s will come into the 1800s and actually come to the fore and be adopted in the early 1900s out of the church. Methodism and Presbyterianism and Congregationalism. And though I am not sure that I would have been, and I'm a supporter, obviously, of prohibition, yet there was great need to address the crisis that was going on in this country. If you think alcohol is bad now or presents any kind of problem, go and read how many were affected by alcoholism in this country in the 1800s. It was staggering. The church tried to respond to it. The abolition of slavery, certainly not solely opposed by the church, but predominantly is going to come out of the church. In 1769, churches are going to begin to preach against slavery. In 1833, Lane Seminary in Cincinnati is going to try and, it really becomes the center of it, and they try and squelch it. The students leave and form Oberlin College, which is going to become a center, a Christian university that is going to seek to deal with slavery in this country. We know that in 1833, the American Anti-Slavery Society is going to be formed predominantly out of Christian churches and Christian people working with it. Many denominations are going to be formed and split at this time over this issue of slavery. The Southern Baptist Convention, the Northern Baptist Convention, Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, they're going to split over this issue. It's going to be the church that's going to at least seek to call Christians to deal with this great evil in our land. How about urbanization? As I've tried to already give you, city life in this country was most dreadful. But think about what was going to come as this industrialization and immigration causing this great urbanization was coming to the fore. You get things like the Water Street Mission in New York, formed in 1872. In Chicago, you're going to get this Pacific Garden Mission to try to address the needs of the urban poor. The Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA, is going to be born in Boston in 1851 to deal with the youth. The Young Women's Christian Association, the YWCA in 1855, Goodwill Industries in 1900, the Salvation Army in the 1800s. These are, through and through, at the beginning, Christian organizations seeking to deal with the social needs of people in our cities and our country in the 1800s. How about England? William Wilberforce, we all know his efforts to outlaw the slave trade. Lord Shaftesbury to work for the laws against unfair child labor in the sweatshops of industrial England. fine Christian men as he sought to deal with the conditions of chimney sweeps and mine workers and reform of the insane asylums and lodging houses. You know, as I went through this list and was compiling it, it did make me think, what are we doing today? What comes to our mind today? I guess we have no social needs today. What comes to the fore when you think about the Christian church uniting? I say that as just to provoke thinking, but to think about the church had needs and they were seeking to address the culture that they were in. What are we doing today that comes to this level? John Howard was a sheriff. I'm not sure exactly what the full position or title was, but he was the head sheriff of England. And he, with Elizabeth Fry, are going to work for prison reform, which was most dreadful then. I can only imagine that any prison in its best day is going to be a hard place to be. But if you think prisons are bad today, read about what they were like in the 1800s in this country or in England. It was a most despicable, inhumane place. And so it was Christians who were going to seek to address that need. Again, the YMCA and the YWCA is going to spread to England. Well, let's talk about missionary endeavors in the time that we have here, which is really the basis of what we want to do. Remember, in the background, not in the 1800s, but prior, we saw some limited missionary activity coming out of the church. But it is not, it is striking. It is unusual that there was not a lot of missionary activity, substantial missionary activity in the 1500s and the 1600s and really even into the 1700s. And the four that I'm going to mention to you in just a minute are very narrow in their scope and were not predominant in Christianity. A lot of reasons why that could be. Some of them would say that missionary activity only applied to the apostolic age and not to today and their day. Others didn't have a burden for it. It's a striking thing to think about. But we know the Moravians were an example where they would send people to the Caribbean, the Far East, and Africa, and Greenland. The French Huguenots would seek to establish missions in Brazil. Remember, you saw that it was the Brazilians that had French influence there. The Dutch colonists are going to seek to plant churches in Indonesia. By the way, neither the French Huguenots nor the Dutch are going to have much success, but at least they did attempt to do it. And then finally, if you were to come to the New England experiment, that is, those in the New England colonies, you'll get names like John Eliot, who's going to seek to be missionaries to the Algonquin Indians. And he'll chiefly seek to, first of all, get the Bible translated into their language and to create a grammar so that then they would be able to study the Bible. And he had a real heart for the Indians here in New England. And we know David Brainerd well, missionary to the Seneca and Delaware Indians. But when you think about it, and I'm sure this is not an exhaustive list, but it is the main list. If that's the missionary activity for the 1600s, 1700s, that's not a lot, is it? It's going to change, though, thankfully. The church's efforts. Well, let's look at what they're going to seek to do in England. In 1792, we're going to get what is called the Baptist Missionary Society. We'll talk more about this because I want to spend some time on the life of William Carey. But it's going to send William Carey and this poor trio to India, Carey and Marshman and Ward. And we're going to see their great work and influence in trying to spread the work of Christ in India. We'll talk more about that. But in 1795, you're going to get the London Missionary Society. Now, here is a change in church history. What missionary activity that you had before this was predominantly going to come out of churches. But now we're seeing the rise of societies. And a society is a group of churches coming together for the effort of sending out missionaries. It is not church-based, it is society-based. And both Carey, as well as this David Livingstone and the London Missionary Society, would be a change, a marked change in the late 1700s. Good or the bad, there's lots of different opinions on that. Nevertheless, it is a marked change in church history. It's also interesting to note that in 1792, the Baptist Missionary Society was a group of churches that came together that were particular Baptist churches. The London Missionary Society, in contrast to that, will be a group of churches from across denominations, Methodist, Anglican, Baptist, General Baptist, Arminian Baptist, that will come together to support missionary work. Again, a particular twist that is coming to fore into church history, and we'll see it really come into play even in our day. Well, you all know the story of David Livingstone, who is going to be a missionary to Africa from 1813 to 1873. You know the story that really what drove him in his missionary endeavors and his desire to open up Africa to missionary activity was his seeing in the morning the smoke of 1,000 villages. And he could just envision that all of those villages knew nothing of Christ. And it kept moving him day after day to go deeper and deeper into Africa so that he could open them up and reach them for Christ. His three C's, Christianity, commerce, and civilization. He is an explorer and an abolitionist as well. He would be a defender. I heard one missionary in Dr. Calhoun's lectures that I listened to this weekend talk about the fact that if you go to many countries in Africa, David Livingstone is a hero. Cities named after him, statues throughout the country where they seek to honor him. And one observation that they made was is that what stood out clearly in Livingstone's mindset was that he was an equal with the Africans and not a superior. Remember what we said about colonization. When we go to colonize, they're there for us. We're not there for them. But that was not David Livingstone's approach. In 1799, we're going to get the Church Missionary Society here. It's an evangelical Anglican church. And I put this one here for a couple reasons. First of all, the name Henry Martin, well-known missionary in our circles here. But it came out of the Anglican church. And I stress this point, though the Anglican church was dying and dying quickly, there was still life in the Anglican church. So J.C. Ryle would be a good name to remember in the 1800s, and certainly his as well. The Church Missionary Society was an evangelical society in the Anglican church seeking to spread the gospel of Christ. Well, what about America? What about the church efforts here? Well, in 1810, we have the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missionaries. Now, that's a mouthful, isn't it? The American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missionaries. It was formed out of Congregational and Presbyterian churches. How did it come about? Well, in Williams College, there were a group of young people whose heart was burdened for the world. One day, they were out walking, and a thunderstorm came up, and so they took a shelter in haystacks, kind of an unusual place. I don't know that that's a great place to hide from lightning if I were them today, knowing I guess they hadn't read much of Benjamin Franklin, but nevertheless they did. And while the storm was going on in the haystacks, they held a prayer meeting. And out of that, they were so moved that they were going to form the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, and it will be the first society of missionary work from this country started by. And I think one of the great lessons that we need to take out of this is we should never despise what the Lord is doing among youths. Granted, they should be tested. It should be held up to the Scriptures. But just because they're young doesn't mean it isn't of Christ. And we should, I think, pay particular attention, if church history is any example to us. David Brainerd was very young when his work was going on. When you look at these people, these were really teenagers in early 20s that the Lord was using to establish the first society for missions in our country. When we go to judge what the Lord is doing among us, we should be asking the question, what is God doing among our young people? Why did He do so much among young people before? Is He not doing it now? Predominantly in this country, it was among the young people that the Lord was working. And we saw that clearly in college revivals. We could have done a whole lecture upon revivals in universities, both at Harvard and Yale and Princeton. Many of the great awakenings are going to be among young people. Well, out of this, you're going to get some no-names like Adoniram Judson. And what happens is Adoniram Judson is one of those that's going to come out of the American Board of Commissioners. He basically is going to be one of the first five missionaries in 1811 going to be sent by the American Board of Commissioners. And what happens is the five of them being sent to the Far East, two of them, they all were studying, but two of them studying their Greek New Testaments as they're riding their boats over, come to the conclusion that we're Baptist and not infant baptism. They weren't paedo-Baptists. And so they're going to, out of that conviction, form the Baptist Missionary Board in 1814. And so we get Adoniram Judson at this time. In 1861, we're going to see the Southern Presbyterian Church do a great work in the Congo or present-day Zaire. And so we're going to have the Southern Presbyterian Church send John Wilson to Africa. And what's unique about this today, I'm told, is that if you go to Zaire, in that part of Africa, you will find over 600,000 Christians, professing Christian Presbyterians in that country as the direct result of his work in 1861. That's fascinating when you think about it. Scotland. In 1824, Thomas Chalmers is going to send the St. Andrew Seven. Six of his students and himself are going to go and serve missions. We'll get in 1847, the Reformed Church of Scotland to send John Peyton to the New Hebrides. And then we come to faith missions. Now, what is faith missions? Faith missions, again, is going to be missions who are not tied to any church at all. Whereas the others would have been an assimilation of churches and closely tied, we'll get faith missions that are not tied to churches. And we'll get someone like, in 1865, the China Inland Mission and Hudson Taylor and his work in China. In 1867 to 1951, Amy Carmichael in India. And so we're going to see the rise of faith missions. Well, in the few minutes that I have remaining here, I want to focus our attention upon William Carey, 1761 to 1834, the father of modern missions. What we've said so far is that the church was faced with great challenges. The context was one of great change and great opportunity, and yet great things that were fighting against the church. Those churches that were going to succumb, like in Germany or in New England, they're going to die and go away. They'll accept Darwinianism. They're going to accept the deism. They're going to accept those things of liberal theology that is going to sap their life away from them, and they'll have really limited role. But to the true churches that Christ was still building and still working in, we're going to see great things come out of it. And so William Carey is an example of that, the father of modern missions. Many of you know he was born in England. He was a shoemaker, a simple man, but yet a man whose passion was for the world. It is said that when he would work, he worked with a globe in front of him. When he was making his shoes, he had that picture of the world. His passion was to see Christ throughout the world. He was converted when he was 17, and he would become a pastor and serve in two different churches. But he's developing a deep sense of a duty for the church, and him personally, later, to take the gospel overseas. He wasn't satisfied to sit back and wait. There's a story that is told, well, I'll get to that in a minute. There were five common objections that Carey had to refute as he sought to instill a passion for missions. The first one was, there's no duty to go. We have no duty to go and take the gospel. There's a story told of a deacon when Carey was actually a young man before he was a pastor, having this burden for missions. He was told by the deacon to sit down, young man. When it pleases the Lord to convert the heathen, he'll do it without your help or mine. Remember what we said. The great particular Baptist here is going to understand clearly that God is sovereign and only God saves people. But we have a great duty to work and to strive and to risk ourselves. And that is the great lesson, I think, of Carey. Well, after that, and reflecting on that, he's going to write in 1792 an inquiry into the obligation of Christians to use means for the conversions of the heathen. And our great confession of faith talks about the fact that God uses means, and we see it coming to the fore. Yes, God is sovereign, and it is God that is going to work. But in His purposes, He has chosen to use our feeble means, chiefly of preaching the gospel, but also of loving people to convert them. Well, the second objection that he would have to is it's too far to go. Now, that really does sound like a poor excuse, doesn't it? Especially when you start to think about the exploration that was going to happen in the 1800s. It wasn't too far for business to go. The Dutch East India Companies, the English East Indian Companies, all of these companies didn't find it too far to go to do business. But why would the church find it too far to go to spread the gospel? How about, what are we going to eat? That's a good objection that he's going to have to... You're right, you're probably not going to get... I don't know what the English eat over there, but you're probably not going to get hamburgers, and you're probably not going to get steak, and you're probably not going to get what you normally do. But is Christ worth it? The savages will kill us. Maybe so. But is Christ worth risking? The language barrier is too great, and that is a legitimate concern. How are we going to deal with that? I was struck by the fact that William Carey translated the Bible, or some portions of the Bible himself, into 35 different languages. Ponder that. I assume he had some gray matter between his ears. 35 different languages. That is an accomplishment. And it is truly a great barrier. If you don't know the people's language, God has said that His principal means for spreading the gospel is through the preaching of the Word. And if you can't preach in their tongue and they don't know your tongue, how will you communicate the gospel? Well, there are ways to overcome it. Well, Carey is going to join with 12 other pastors to form this mission society. And he's going to seek to recruit missionaries to go. And much to his dismay, he can't get any. And so what does he do? He says, I'll go. And so he leaves. And he'll leave with his wife for India. Dorothy Carey does not want to go. She steadfastly did not want to go. I don't know how to process this, but he took her and she went with him after he agreed to take her sister to go along. Sadly to say, though, in India, she'll suffer a nervous breakdown and go insane before dying in India. It's a sad chapter. I don't know how to process that in William Carey's life, but it was his dear wife, who he loved very much, was a great sorrow to him that this chapter happened in his life. And you read about it, it is quite crushing. He will marry two more times, be happily married in both of those marriages. Both wives will die while he's in India. But William Carey was passionate for reaching India, and he went. He will have children, 5 children, with his marriage with Dorothy, and one will die in India. I believe the other 4 will outlive him, as I recall. The Serampore Covenant is established. What is the Serampore Covenant? Well, as I told you, the British forbid him from preaching the gospel in their colony. But just to the north in India, the Dutch had established a colony, and so Carey will go to Serampore, which was the Dutch colony, and he will establish his base of ministry from there. He will be joined by 2 others, Ward and Marshman, and they will establish the Serampore Covenant. In the remaining minutes, I just want to spend some time going through this, because I think this is a document that every one of us, myself included, should have in our possession and be familiar with its 11 points. And the reason why I say that is that I believe our church has gone through, and this is just my opinion, a peculiar time in these last 5 years where our heart has become more worldwide in its scope for Christ. And it continues, and the Lord seems to be blessing in what He is doing here. But how do we judge our success and our methods and our means? Well, I'm not saying this is the perfect judge. Certainly the scriptures are going to be what we hold our activities up to. But William Carey and these men put together a covenant that I find fascinating. And I think we ought to be familiar with it, and at least we ought to interact with it as we judge what we're doing in the world for Christ. In the missions that we're supporting, whether in the Far East or in Pakistan, or whether in Eastern Europe, whether in Central America, here is the questions that I think should come. First of all, do we set an infinite value on men's souls? I would like to, by the way, these 11 things, I'll just show you. We're not talking about a huge amount of writing here, and I'm going to read some of it to you, but I can't read it all to you. You'll go to sleep if I do. But it's only those 2.5 pages. It's a worthwhile read, and I think it'll make you really think about missions and what comes out of it. Carey says this, "We set an infinite value on immortal souls. This means we need to remind ourselves often of the dreadful future of those who die without knowing Christ. Oh, may our hearts bleed over these poor idolaters. May their situation be a continual weight on our minds, so that we'll be like the Apostle Paul, who compared his burden for those he was sent to reach for Christ with a woman going through labor pains until the baby is born. Do any of us know those pains for any other group of people? It's a fair question to judge your own hearts by. Do any of you have labor pains for others to know Christ?" That was the first thing that Carey set out that must be true for him and the others in his mission. The second thing was, we have to acquaint ourselves with the snares which hold the minds of the people that you're trying to reach for Christ. That's a fascinating thing to think about. He says this, "We have to learn all we can about the pagan snares that delude the minds of the people. We need to converse with them in an intelligible manner. So it is important to be acquainted with their modes of thinking, their habits, what they like and don't like, how they think about God and sin and holiness and the way of salvation. We need to know what their religion means to them and how they go about practicing it if we're to communicate meaningfully with them and not seem to them like barbarians. So we must talk with the people, read their books, and carefully study the way of life that they have." Fascinating. Do we know them? It's not important that they become American, but I do have to know them so that I can minister to them. The third thing that he says is, we must abstain from whatever deepens, and is his context, India's prejudice against the gospel. I told you the British people abused the Indian people. If you read Winston Churchill, it is embarrassing to hear and read what he said about the Indian people, as it is to see what we said about Africans. It's equivalent. He believed they were subhuman. And you see, when India became a country in 1950 and Pakistan was broken off from it, you read that history, it will amaze you as to what went on. And so when Carey went to minister to the Indians, he struggled with this context that they saw him as an Englishman, his accent, his way of life, and he did whatever he could to overcome it. We must not do those things which would increase prejudice against the gospel. There are things about the British ways that repel them. We should be aware of them and avoid them. We would also avoid every degree of cruelty to animals. And we should not begin by attacking their false gods, nor trying to physically destroy their pagan images, nor do anything to disrupt their worship. You see, the British went in there and established their English church and insisted that if you're going to be in their society, you had to do it through their church. If the gospel is to prevail, it will be through love and exalting Jesus. Fascinating. The next thing that he said was, we must watch for every chance for doing good to the people. We eagerly seek all opportunities to do good. A missionary would be highly culpable if he contented himself with preaching 2 or 3 times a week to those persons whom he might be able to get together into a place of worship. We must converse with the natives almost every hour in the day, to go from village to village, from market to market, from one assembly to another, to talk to the servants and laborers as often as opportunity affords, and to do them good. We must seek to preach Christ crucified as the grand means of conversions. This was fascinating. He will refer, I won't take time to read it because we'll run out of time, to the Moravians. Remember, If you remember one thing about the Moravians, and to some degree there was going to be an imbalance in the Moravians in this, almost a fixation. But does anybody remember the lecture on the Moravians? What stood out about the Moravians? What was their focus on? Does anybody remember? This is a quiz here now. The blood of Christ. Five bleeding wounds. Think about Zinzendorf's theology in his hymns. He talks about Christ being sacrificed. Well, what Carey's picking up here is we've got to go in and tell them about Christ. We have to tell them about who he is and what he did and how he died and what he did for them. Certainly, he understood that. To esteem and treat Indians always as our equals. That's an interesting thing. Think about that. As our equals. We must do all that we can to help the people here trust us and feel quite at home in our company. To gain their confidence, we must always be willing to hear their complaints. We must give them the kindest advice, and we must decide upon everything brought before us in the most open, upright, and impartial manner. They need to feel that we're always available to them and consider them as our equals. To guard and build up the hosts that may be gathered, we must pay careful attention to strengthen the guide those who come to faith. We need to start with the simplest precepts and then to press the greatest principles of the gospel upon their minds till they be thoroughly settled and grounded in the foundation of their hope. He goes on later to say, we place the highest value and esteem. Now this is important and I don't have time to develop it. I wish that I could. One of the things that we're going to see in the missionary movement is going to be the involvement of women in a predominant way in the role of missions. Some of them were based upon the fact of racist views of people that they were trying to reach. And what I mean by that is, and rightfully so, and scripturally so, we allow in our church, for example, women to teach children in Sunday school. And that day, they would allow women to go to Africa to be missionaries and preach because they were preaching to someone who was less than human than a white man. That's a fascinating context for missions, and it is true, something that you really have to wrestle through when you look at the missions movement in Africa in that same context. But Carey is going to try and wrestle with the role of women in his day. And he says this, we place the highest value and esteem upon the important role of the women in our mission calling. They have a vital role in ministering to the native women here, just as women played an important part in the apostolic era. The Asiatic women are mostly shut up from men, and especially from men of another caste. So we must give our European sisters all possible help in acquiring the language that they may become instrumental in promoting the salvation of the millions of native women who are in a great measure excluded from all opportunities of hearing the word from the mouths of male European missionaries. Interesting to really try and think through the role of women in missions. But clearly what he was saying here is, I have no audience with women. I cannot because of the caste system that is established in India. I am greatly hindered. I need European sisters to come and minister alongside of me. Ponder that. Sure, it will give you food for thought. To cultivate their spiritual gifts, ever pressing upon their missionary obligation, since Indians only can win India for Christ. I think we here at our church have bought into this. We understand clearly that our role is not to go in and make them Americans. Our role, as God enables us, is to go in and preach the gospel, and if he blesses, to see the converts come and to train them to do the work of missionary work. That is a key, and he followed it. I wish I could spend more time here, but I can't. To labor increasingly, or I should say unceasingly, in biblical translation. The importance of getting the Bible. And I think we understand that concept and agree with it, and I won't take time to do that. I'll read this. He says, we will labor with all our might in Bible translation in the various languages of that land. The next thing that he says is in number 10, to be instant in the nurture of personal religion. We must be constant in prayer and the cultivation of personal religion. He's talking about his own heart. Like missionary David Brainerd in the woods of America, pouring out his very soul before God for those without Christ, without whose salvation nothing could make him happy. We will be fervent in spirit, wrestling with God, till he famishes the idols here and causes the unconverted to experience the blessedness that is in Christ. And lastly, to give ourselves without resolve to the cause, not counting even the clothes we wear our own. We'll give all, whatever it takes, to reach these people for Christ. There is no price, humanly speaking, too great. Well, the Serampore Covenant, just go home, Google those words. You'll get it very clearly. It's very easy to get. Read the whole thing. Read over it. Judge what we're as a church doing for missions and see where we stand in the light of it. I think it's a great document and a great help and a good exercise. Well, observations from our lessons today. The first thing I would say is don't despise youth. It is so easy to say when we see something bubbling up in our youth, that's just inexperience, or to write it off. Who knows what God is doing with our summer missions to those in our youth who have a desire to do something? Church history dictates to us that God worked in many ways, in many different times, through very young people. I think the next thing that I would say is that we have to study one's culture and be attuned for opportunities to serve Christ. Now, I'm sad to say that I'm on the other end of youth. I'm past that 40 mark, which is the traditional hillside mark. But what I mean to say is this. Do we know our culture? How many of you use Facebook or Twitter or Flickr? How many of you know the internet inwards and outwards? It is where the culture is going today. And if you do not, you have a very real chance of becoming irrelevant to our culture. Think about what Carey said about understanding the Indian people. Is it not true even of our own culture? Is it not necessary for us to understand the trends? I'm not saying we have to adopt evil, but these things that I've already mentioned are not evil in and of themselves. Are we using them to spread the gospel of Christ? Think about it. Are we irrelevant to our culture? And then finally, in a bigger picture here, I think what we see in the 1800s is this. Euro-American Christianity is going to transition to a world Christianity. When you study Christianity today, I think you will see that the up-and-coming, the happening place, is not America, and it's certainly not Europe. It's Africa. It's the Far East. And we think the world revolves around us, but I think we think wrong. There are far greater movements for Christ's work in Africa and the Far East than there are here. And we may look at China as some backwoods, podunk, developing backwater. But from the church's perspective, in many ways, the American church is in the dustbin of history, and the future is not here. At least ponder that. I think we see in the 1800s and certainly in the 1900s, Christianity is not confined in church history to two continents. It is truly a world religion. And it is vibrant. It may be different than us, but it is vibrant and it is alive and it's in love with Christ. And so we need to be aware of that, and we need to get our heads out of America and think more globally in that aspect of it. Well, I hope this has been encouraging to you. It's really just a thumbnail. It is not very detailed, but I hope it will whet your appetite to go further and to think more deeply about the work of Christ and how effective we are and what we can learn from the past and what we can use going forward. May God bless what we've said to His glory. Thank you all.